The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
If you are passionate about food and how it supports well-being and health, learn more. The Institute for Optimum Nutrition has been training nutritional therapists for 35 years on its highly acclaimed and accredited diploma courses. Start your new career in nutritional therapy, one that will make a difference and help others achieve their health goals. Train with the home of nutritional therapy education. Find us online and give us a call or click on the IOM banner on the UK Health Radio homepage.
Hello and welcome to the Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that has, for the last 15 years, been helping people with cancer to take an integrative approach to their treatment, a holistic approach that includes both conventional and complementary therapies. My guest on the Yes to Life show today was also my very first guest over 200 shows ago. Jerome Byrne is a freelance medical journalist for national newspapers. He's a blogger and a published author, with most of his writings questioning the status quo in some way. He's also a valued trustee of Yes to Life and strongly supports our drive for patient choice and patient empowerment. I'm talking to Jerome over Skype at his home in West London. Hi Jerome, welcome back to the Yes to Life show. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Great, lovely to be here.
So, you have been heard to borrow a staple presidential phrase when describing the dependability of the system that tests and approves drugs for cancer. So, given the enormous investment in trialling and the considerable edifice that constitutes the approval mechanisms here in the UK and elsewhere in the world, what leads you to describe the idea that this is a reliable system as fake news?
Well, rather slightly worrying to be linked up with Trump, but certainly the fake news phrase is coming to be used a lot more in medicine, more, I think, in some ways by the people who are objecting to being criticised. It's not just cancer where you've got people saying, the way you're testing these drugs is not really useful. In fact, it's more common in other areas like statins is probably the big one, or, mm-hmm. or to get really controversial, people who have criticisms about vaccines.
Right.
A very sensitive area. And the idea that anybody who makes any criticism of vaccines is, this is fake, this is rubbish, this is nonsense, this is dangerous. It's an aggressive attempt to preserve the status quo. In the case of cancer, I'm trying to challenge it from the other end and to say that the assumption that we have a perfect system for assessing what works and what doesn't and what we can rely on is not the case. It's a delusion. And it's a comforting delusion because we all want to believe that we're being treated, given the best treatment, that the intentions of the system is to provide us with really effective and safe treatments. Mm. But there's a lot of evidence to suggest that there are serious problems with the way we assess drugs. I can go perhaps into some of the problems with drugs in general.
Yes, that'd be great if you would. Thank you.
If that would be useful, because it cancer sometimes seems to be talked about as something just on its own. It's, it's a special area, and it obviously is in terms of A, the money, and B, the alarm it creates in people. Mm-hmm. But it is part of an overall system which has a lot of commonalities. So if we just take what's happened to Yes to Life recently? Mm-hmm. We have been unsurprisingly attacked recently for promoting treatments which have no evidence or have virtually no evidence, or have been rejected by mainstream cancer organisations as being ineffective and not backed up by any kind of evidence. You've probably got a rather better grip than I have on exactly what those ones are, because you've been more closely involved in it. Can you just give us two or three examples of the kind of thing that is routinely rejected, even though people working in the non-drug area find them quite useful?
Well, I would say some front runners of things that, yes, very many people are finding useful would be a diet of one kind or another, you know, particularly maybe the ketogenic diet. Vitamin C, high dose vitamin C, always been extraordinarily useful. And more and more people are turning to oxygen therapies to support the other treatments.
And these were ones which were mentioned as fairly brief rebuttal, saying there is no evidence for this. This one has had a trial which found that it had no evidence, and therefore any attempt to claim that they might be beneficial is dangerous, could be harming patients, unscientific, and so on. It's quite interesting to contrast this rejection of any kind of non-drug treatments with the way that drug treatments are handled. For example, very recently, some research came out which was looking at the influence of drug companies in mental health units of all of the trusts, health trusts in England. There's right. about 50 of them. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to find out what the sort of drugs that they use, what sort of evidence there was supporting them, and how much influence the drug companies had. And one of the, what I found was rather remarkable statistics was that there's long been a big debate about antidepressants. We currently use, according to some recent figures, there are now 65 million prescriptions for antidepressants written for a population of 55 million. Wow. So not just blanket coverage, but over blanket coverage.
Right.
So you might think that if we had a proper and efficient way of evaluating these things, that there would be, it would be absolutely irrefutable that these drugs were beneficial.
Right.
In fact, this report on the use of antidepressants in these trusts says that there have been 131 RCTs that are done, which have been included in a major meta-analysis, which had over 27,000 patients who were taking antidepressants. And the sum of the conclusion on this particular, this looking at these 131 trials, was that there was the overall effect of these drugs, these antidepressants, did not reach the threshold for clinical significance.
Wow.
So, in other words, they don't work, they barely work at all, any better than a placebo.
Amazing.
Yet, you've got a 100% increase in their use over the last 10 years. So the idea that it's all very well established, you run them through this RCT system and the answer comes out the other end, yes, no. Obviously, it's hugely more complicated than that. And very often we're getting results which aren't that impressive at all. Another one, which I'll just mention quickly because it's a long, complicated story, but statins. Everybody knows that we should all be put on statins in order to save us or reduce our risk of getting heart disease. Quite a lot of very articulate and well-informed critics of this view, who are now in the fake news arena being described as statin deniers.
Right.
First of all, their the number of people who need to take a statin in order to cut their risk of developing heart disease if they haven't had heart disease before is huge. I mean, figures vary a lot, but it could be 1 in 100, 1 in 150 and so on is going to benefit. So massive amount of taking of these drugs. And of course, they come with side effects. And this is another heavily disputed area, but they do raise your risk of diabetes. They do risk your risk of cataracts, which is not as well known as a diabetes link. And of course, they cause the muscle pain and the rest of it, which may well stop you exercising, which in turn may actually increase your risk of a heart disease. So it's worth just mentioning what the claims that statins are effective and good is based on. And they're based on a research group in Oxford who hold all of the trials done on statins, which have been used to promote their benefit. And there have been endless studies that have been published in journals and so on. But the raw material of all of these trials are held by this unit in Oxford called CTT. Mm-hmm. And the point about it is that no independent investigator has ever been able to look at this raw material. So what happens is that the unit produces analyses of it every year or so. They're still going through this millions and millions of pages of results and saying that, yes, more statins are taken, yes, the more the cholesterol is lowered, better the results, and so on. And no one's been able to check the raw material. And it's known from all sorts of other fields that the opportunities for fudging results and moving people from placebo category to the treatment category and so on and back again is enormous. What we're being asked to do is to take this effectiveness of statins on trust. And so that's the kind of context. And when we come and be talking shortly about what goes on with the cancer drugs and how reliable the data on that is, which isn't quite as good as we're led to believe, or not nearly as good as we're led to believe. But you can see that overall there is a readiness to play kind of fast and loose with data, right, when especially with drugs, and even more so when it comes to how beneficial non-drug treatments are. And I'll give you just one example. I know we've got a lot of ground to cover, but I think this is a particularly telling one.
Okay.
Is in the case of the possible benefit of B vitamins for in case of people with Alzheimer's. And this is really quite a classic example of a non-drug approach, which was really carefully done, that all the stuff that people are calling for, we need to have proper trials, we need to have it all done, randomized and controlled and so on and so forth. And this is what happened when one of those trials was done on B vitamins for Alzheimer's, which ticked all the boxes. There's long been evidence that there's a link between Alzheimer's and homocysteine, which is an amino acid, which you shouldn't have too much of in your system. You need it, but if it starts building up, you know you've got a problem. Mm-hmm. And people with Alzheimer's had high levels of homocysteine. And in order to bring the levels down, you need to have sufficient levels of B vitamins, particularly B12. So the idea was, give people B12, and this will reduce their homocysteine and will get their brain functioning better or prevent it running into problems. Mm-hmm. Not proven, but an interesting, plausible idea. A researcher in Oxford took a group of people who were already having problems and gave them very high doses of B vitamins and found a their mental state didn't get worse over about a two-year period. And this was a double-blinded, two groups compared, all that kind of stuff. And then at the end of it, they took brain scans of these patients. They had them at the very beginning and at the end. And the areas of decline of cell loss in the brain, there's a particular pattern which shows up with Alzheimer's, has hardly changed. So wow. The giving the B vitamins, bringing down the homocysteine, had really held things. And the idea, obviously, next step would have been to test and see whether it could stop it from developing. Right. Hugely impressive, very encouraging research. What do you think happened? First of all, it wasn't press released, and it was essentially ignored by the establishment when it came out. About a year later, a trial of vitamins to see whether it would have an effect on brain patterns for Alzheimer's was run. What they did was, in this trial, done by a top unit in Oxford, again, was they, first of all, they gave it to people who were healthy,
right,
not people who had any sign of cognitive decline. Secondly, they gave it to anybody in the group and made no attempt to find out whether their levels of homocysteine were high or low. And at the end of that, giving extra B vitamins to people who were healthy with no problems with homocysteine did nothing for their cognitive performance because there wasn't anything to be done.
Right.
However, the conclusion was, really sorry, but this trial shows that B vitamins don't work for Alzheimer's.
Right.
Now, that's not proper science. But if you were to approach, and this happened several times at the time, this was done a couple of years ago, about 4 years ago, if you'd approached any one of the Alzheimer's societies and asked about B vitamins, they would refer you to this piece of research. Either they absolutely didn't know what they were doing, or they knew and were clearing the ground for a drug approach, because, of course, drugs, a drug for Alzheimer's is worth multi-billions, and they don't want to sound cynical, but I think there's a reasonable to say they don't really want competition in there. So that's the a very quick overview, as it were, of why simply saying, oh, well, we've got a system in place that can assess things, give you reliable accounts of drugs and of non-drugs, hugely fake news. I think it's not unreasonable to claim that.
Right. Okay. Well, look, that very interesting. Thank you for that, Jerome. Can we now, as you said, go on now to look a bit more closely at the problems within cancer drugs, which, as you say, it's a sort of an isolated field in a certain kind of way, in as much as it's a very protected area of treatment where there are huge amounts of money being made, and it gets treated in a special way by the government as well. So it's definitely in the public's mind as a sort of special department, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I'm sort of a bit naive, I think, in some ways. As a journalist, I think when there's a really extraordinary study comes out, people should be interested in it and people should cover it and talk about it. There was one amazing study to do with cancer drugs and their reliability, which came out 2 or 3 years ago, which was published in the BMJ, one of the top medical journals. And the conclusion to it was almost two-thirds, in other words, 57% of cancer drugs authorised by the European Medicines Agency between 2009 and 2013 came onto the market, and this is the key bit, without any clear evidence they improve the quality or quantity of patients' lives. Now, that's, I found, shocking.
How does that happen?
Well, what happens is that the way that cancer drugs are regulated or rather the licensing procedure, what you have to do is you have to present data to show that your drug is safe and also is effective. And then the agency says, you know, yes or no. That's the theory. In the case of cancer drugs, you don't have to show that the drugs actually make anybody live any longer, nor do you have to show that they improve the quality of life. What you do have to show is that they affect some biomarkers, which can be taken to indicate that they're doing something beneficial. In the case of cancer drugs, that biomarker is very often shrinking a tumour. So you give people heavy doses of chemotherapy, their cancer, their tumour shrinks, and this is taken as a sign that it's an effective drug and it will increase people's lifespan. Mm-hmm. This actually isn't the case, that as a marker for what's going to happen later, tumour shrinkage is not very reliable. And in terms of what happens to the patients, that data also isn't gathered at the point where the drug is licensed. What very often happens, or it should happen, is that they then follow people, get feedback, how they do and so on, but very often that isn't done either. So these drugs come onto the market. The rationale is that cancer is such a dreadful condition that we need to get treatments out there to help patients, to help save lives as fast as possible.
Right.
What it means is that patients are getting drugs which, rather than having gone through a careful evaluation system, are actually more in the nature of an experiment. The number of people in the trials will have been 500, maybe 1,000 or so, and then that's being put out to thousands of people.
Yes.
So, in fact, rather ironically, one of the big criticisms that's made of the non-drug approaches to cancer, treatments to cancer, is that they give false hope, that you tell people that a Gerson diet or vitamin C or something will help you, and people, because they're desperate, say, yeah, oh, right, yes, let's try it. And this is giving false hope, and this is something which the medical profession doesn't approve of. And in fact, the way that these drugs were licensed was formally described in the BMJ article as giving cancer patients false hope.
Wow, right.
So, the same thing was going on in America. There's similar studies coming out in America showing the same kind of lack of benefit on it. So how do we know that these drugs weren't very useful? Well, as it happens, there's another bit of evidence gathering about cancer drugs, which also was rather shocking. So the Cancer Drug Fund, just for those who are not up to speed with these things, Cancer Drug Fund was set up by David Cameron in a very curious way, because the official system is that when a drug is licensed by the EU, or by, usually always done by the EU these days, there's then a backstop, as it were, in the form of NICE. And NICE then has to itself look at the drugs and say, what are we getting, you know, are we going to allow these drugs to be paid for in the NHS? And a number of drugs which came through from the EU system, the NICE said, evidence doesn't seem that good, and so it said no. And there was then a big newspaper, complaint that people were being denied life-saving treatments.
Yes.
And there was attacks on you know, the knife was allowing people to die, simply scrimping and saving and so on. So Cameron set up something to consciously reverse decisions made by another arm of government which had said we shouldn't have them.
Right.
So the Cancer Drug Fund would make available for patients whose consultants said, yes, this could help them, would make these rejected drugs that had been passed but rejected by NICE available. So if something good was going on with this EU system, that should have shown up that there were people who had been denied effective treatment and benefited from it.
Right.
The Cancer Drug Fund ran for quite a period of time. And then in 2015, I think maybe it was 5 years it ran, 2015, they started to have a look at and see how it had done, because it had kept records of how many people had got the drugs and so on. And a study which was reported in The Lancet found that the result of spending £1.3 billion to provide these drugs to patients on a kind of off-label basis had resulted in no clinical benefit at all.
Right.
Now, I'd have thought that that would be a good reason to have parliamentary commissions and hearings and who knew what when and why weren't steps taken and so on and so forth,
right.
But nothing. The decision was to reinstate the Cancer Drug Fund, because it had come to the end of its life then, reinstate it, but get it done a bit more carefully.
Right. And
one of the things that the drugs that had been passed through by the EU were supposed to do was to gather up data as to what had happened when people had got the drugs. And the Cancer Drug Fund was supposed to be doing that and hadn't done it. So that, again, was a further failure. Not only was it giving drugs which weren't effective, but it didn't even follow them up. And even that wasn't enough to get people to say, let's stop it. So they set it up again, gave more funding to it, but made the drug companies promise that they would follow up rather more efficiently.
Mm.
So this picture of having these drugs, which have gone through these trials and all being tested and so on and so forth, and are being given to patients with a lot of backing behind them, is fake news, frankly. It's not what happens.
Right.
In that kind of context, the idea of people wanting to do something else makes an awful lot of sense.
Right.
Just
to comment on what you just said, it kind of displays the enormous resilience of the idea that cancer medicines are good and they work, and putting money into cancer medicines is always a good thing to do. That, you know, flies completely in the face of the facts that you've just given us, obviously, but it's actually survived, isn't it?
I think that it's a combination of two things. One is that cancer is very terrifying, and the kind of stuff that I'm talking about here is actually not welcome for people, for perfectly understandable reasons.
Yes.
They don't want to hear it. They want to be told, you know, you've got cancer, your mum's got cancer, you want to know that the guy who's in charge knows, guy or man or woman who's in charge, knows what they're doing, they're trained, this is what their professional expertise is with, and they're going to do everything they can to, to get you or mum better.
Yes.
And to be told, actually, the evidence that they're going to be able to do it is really not nearly as good as you'd hoped. That's frightening and horrible. And may well, we know that a positive mental attitude can help. I may be making people less responsive to drugs by saying this, but it seems to me the other way to say is that what's needed is a system that is a bit more on the side of the patients.
Yes.
Rather than trying to get drugs out there as fast as possible.
Yes. Mm. Right.
So, enough of depressing.
Right. Okay.
Where can we go from here?
Where can we go from here? Well, look, there's another subject I'd like to talk about, which is more promising in many ways, which surrounds some recent developments in mainstream attitudes towards cancer as a disease. I know this is something you've written about a bit, that Siddhartha Mukherjee, who's a leading oncologist and writer, he's been pushing the boundaries of the sort of view of cancer by talking about the cancer environment, something which is a bit of an alternative medicine subject, if you like, by directly comparing other situations in nature. He suggested that the environment in which a problem such as cancer exists is actually more predictive of the outcome than any aspect of the actual cancer itself. So that's something I know that you and I got a bit excited about when he wrote that, because it was coming from an unusual quarter. Do you want to explain a bit more about his suggestions?
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk a bit more about what Mukherjee, what his proposal was, which was, yeah, was absolutely fascinating. And in fact, there's this month in Scientific American, there's been a big article which is in the same sort of territory.
Right.
It's kind of linking in cancer and Darwinian ideas of natural selection and so on. So, and it comes up with a slightly different, but it's certainly putting cancer within an evolutionary ecological context rather than this very narrow focus on the genes.
Right.
And this was one of the insights that Mukherjee had, which was, I think, incredibly radical when he did, because Mukherjee is a top internationally acclaimed cancer specialist. He wrote a very hugely best-selling and highly regarded book called, I think it was The Emperor of All Maladies, something,
yes,
like that,
yes,
which is all about cancer. He's, you know, a brilliant man. And he pointed out that there is a sort of mystery, as it were, about the central problem with cancer, which is when cancer has metastasized, when it's spread from its original site to elsewhere in the body, your chances of survival are not that good. Some people do survive. I mean, there are, you know, 5 years is the official, you've kind of beaten cancer, and people do reach that. But you've got a much better chance of never having cancer return if you can get it before it's metastasized.
Right.
If you can cut it out, that's the best thing. But so the question is, how can you tell whether a cancer is likely to metastasize? And there really isn't a good guide. So what happens is that people have their surgery and then they get adjuvant chemotherapy to cut the risk of it coming back again.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very scattershot thing, because you advise it to everybody because they don't know which ones are more likely to. And the reason they don't know is because all of the concentration on genes says what a cancer is going to do, what's happening with the cancer, is to do with gene change. But there's nothing, if you peer down into the DNA of a cancer cell, there's nothing in there that says this is what goes on with metastasizing. There's,
right,
stuff about turning off genes for apoptosis, and there are other ones about plugging into the local blood supply, all sorts of changes to the genes of a cancer cell. But none of them tell you, is this going to metastasize?
Right.
So Mukherjee's insight was to say, actually, the key to metastasizing is not what's in the genes, but is what's in the surroundings, in your body. Is your body able to keep cancer under control or not? And he uses the example of invasive species, where you've got, knotweed. Knotweed, that thing which grows massively, a Japanese plant that grows incredibly speedily and takes over English gardens and things. Yeah. Another example is apparently, I only learned this recently, beavers in southern Chile and Argentina, who have invaded there and have kind of taken over large areas and caused flooding and all the rest of it and so on. There are lots of examples of these invasive species that come into a new territory and take it over, which is one way of thinking about cancer. It's invading territory that should normally keep it at bay, because the beavers in their home territory and knotweed are quite well behaved. They you know, they have their niche and they're kept in line by other things in the environment. And when they go into a new territory, if they're lucky, there's nothing there that keeps them under control, and therefore they can romp away and cause havoc. So the idea then is, what you need to look at is what's going on in the surrounding area and what's going on in the person's body that for some people keeps cancer at bay and for other people lets it romp away. Mm. And this, of course, immediately brings us back to all this kind of stuff that Yes to Life and so on stands for, which is, how do you strengthen the system? How do you support it? What can you do to prevent this expansion of this invader?
Right.
What was really interesting in Mukherjee's, he very clearly, and it was a long article, set out this idea and said that oncologists need to look up from their microscopes, looking at narrow elements of the gene and try to get a broader picture. And he did say at the very end, he said, now this may sound to some people like holism, and that we're talking about a holistic approach to cancer, which I'm not. Holism is, I can't remember exactly the quote, but it was something like, holism is having raspberry flavored herbal concoctions, which they believe is going to save you. I'm not talking about that. And he rather vaguely went into, we're talking about understandable systems like the immune system and so on. Immune system obviously is very important, but he saw the territory that his theory was taking him into and kind of rather like a horse faced with a fence, kind of pulled back and reared and didn't want to go down there.
Right. But it's very interesting, isn't it? It does give legitimacy to all sorts of approaches, that actually anything that strengthens the body's healthy systems.
Absolutely, yeah, yes. Certainly, Yes to Life, you've organised conferences where people talk about the different things, the ketogenic diet and vitamin C and oxygen and all these other things which can make a difference to the environment that the cancer's found in.
Right.
But I think it's worth just mentioning this latest article, which has just come out in Scientific American, which starts off with a brilliant summary of what it's all about, really, is that says, this year, 31,000 men in the US will be diagnosed with prostate cancer that has spread to other parts of the body. They will be treated by highly skilled and experienced oncologists who have access to 52 drugs that are approved to treat metastasized prostate cancer. And yet eventually, more than three quarters of these men will succumb to their illness. And in fact, later on in the article, you get the figure for that the average survival rate is something like 13 months.
Wow. It's not good, is it?
And 52 drugs. So not good. And so why is this? And the big insight of this article is doing a slightly different analogy from ecological perspective, They're not looking at it in terms of an invasive species so much, but at looking at it in terms of pest control, which is obviously very related. And if you look at agriculture, it's now well known that agriculture is a sort of battle against pests. You know, there's all sorts of insects which are ready to eat your crops.
Right.
And so you dust them with lots of pesticides and so on. And it's now established that if you too aggressively do your crop dusting and you're piling on more and more powerful, the insects evolve. They develop resistance. You then end up just having to use more and more, and you're fighting a losing battle, really, or you're fighting a battle which gets more and more expensive, and the effect on the crops as well, and so on. So what is very often done now is that you will do a fairly heavyweight dusting, as it were, and then you'll use a much more maintenance dose. You'll use about half or less to kind of, so that you don't kill off everything, but then leave some that are resistant, because you keep a lower level, which will then keep the ones that are resistant unable to develop very much further. And so the implication then is that you might well start doing this with cancer. So rather than hammering away at someone who's got metastasized cancer and giving them ever stronger and more multiple treatments, you go maybe reduce the tumor size, which most chemotherapy does do, but then bring down the dose so that because cancer cells are mutating in the same way that the pests are. There's the same kind of natural process going on. And there's some reports in here in the article about the success of this approach and how, you know, early days, they're being a bit cautious, but it does seem that they've had a very small number, I mean, sort of 15 or 20 people who've been treated with this approach and using quite sophisticated mathematics and algorithms to actually get the dose exactly right and so on. Mm. And rather than surviving for about 13 months on the standard heavyweight treatment, giving them about half the dose for the rest of the time after the initial one pushes them up to about 36 months.
That's a huge difference. Huge.
Huge. Mm. By giving less chemotherapy.
Mm, amazing.
So that's very interesting. But, of course, they don't talk at all about, in this particular paper, about what else you might be doing.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
It raises the question of if you put those two things together,
right,
the reduced chemo plus diet plus this plus that plus, what kind of results might you be getting? Really exciting and interesting. It seems to me that what I think we may have to move to, and I've no idea how we do it, and it may well be too much of a shift, but it seems to me that to try to incorporate the kind of insights that the problems with drugs and the possibilities of these other approaches and having a terrain and a body system which can resist cancer, it's not really commercially viable. It doesn't fit the marketing model of selling. You know, we've now got a model you get massively expensive, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for drugs. And if you're going to get more and more drugs and then you start looking at some of these alternative things, the big problem with the alternative stuff is that it doesn't generate very much money,
mm-hmm.
which is, if you wanted to be a bit cynical, you might say, well, that's why it's not investigated. That's why there aren't trials of it, because even if it did work, the drug companies wouldn't be interested in it. And this is not a kind of wild conspiracy theory speculation. it's what's happened with antibiotics. And antibiotics have been hit by exactly the same kind of resistance, growing resistance, and the response from the drug companies has been they've got out of the area of antibiotics. Antibiotics have a problem, which is that you can't make enough money out of them, because when you give a treatment, the patient recovers normally or often, and then they don't need any more. And so the problem with resistance is a very serious one for the cancer drugs. And what it means is that you've got a smaller and smaller market for particular drugs, each individual drug, which is going to cost a huge amount to develop. So what the conclusion is in terms of antibiotics is that it needs to be taken into the public sector, and you need to remove the commercial imperatives to develop more antibiotics and get it done as a public health campaign, a policy. It may happen with antibiotics. Whether it happens with cancer, I think, is unlikely, but it might well be good for patients if it did.
Sounds like a good result, actually. Really interesting, Jerome. Look, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. It's all fascinating stuff. It can all seem a bit theoretical and abstract talking about this, but actually the potential that new thinking has to impact on real-world treatment of cancer, it's enormous. How evidence and indeed cancer are perceived, it's profoundly important. So a great topic. Thank you very much.
Okay, it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
If you'd like to read the articles referred to in the last part of our discussion, search for Cancer's Invasion Equation in the New Yorker and for Darwin's Ideas on Evolution, Drive a Radical New Approach to Cancer Drug Use in the Scientific American. Thanks very much for joining me today. Remember to listen in again next week for another Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.